Welcome to WISA Weekend, your weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. We've got a lot coming your way today. Up first, the Dayton Convention Center's future is in question after city leaders announced plans this past week to create a task force to assess the condition of the facility, its finances, and future development potential. City Manager Shelley Dickstein said in a statement that the task force would be led by City Commissioner Christopher Shaw and Chamber of Commerce President Phil Parker. City leaders say the decision follows a feasibility study conducted last year by Crossroads Consulting Services. In our interview with Dayton's deputy city manager, Joe Parlett, he says the Tampa, Florida-based company reported that the convention center needed major renovations that could cost millions.
From our lens, we look at the operation and make decisions just based on finances, generally speaking. And the finances of the convention center operation have not been good over the last several years, requiring subsidy, you know, six-figure subsidies from the general fund on an annual basis for the last several years. So, you know, in hearing that the Dayton Convention Center is important to the community, and you know it's said to be a community asset. We wanted to hear from the community, and particularly the business community here in Dayton, to really get them into the weeds of the numbers as we know them, so that we can make an informed decision for the community as we look forward for the convention center.
All right, you've got some, what I think is some pretty heavy hitters as far as the members who will make up this task force and the organizations that are very involved in development with downtown Dayton. Can you speak a little bit about the time and effort to name these members of the task force?
Yes, the city manager's office suggested to Commissioner Shaw and Mr. Parker from the chamber. We suggested a list of names. They supplemented to that list some additional names. But really, the goal for all of us was to come up with exactly what you said, a list of proven performers, vested interest individuals to really thoughtfully, independently, and with as much information as we can provide them, make a very well-informed decision or suggestion, I should say.
Time frame that you expect this task force to operate on, when would you like to see maybe the first recommendations come through?
Well, we have a general timeline, but this task force will work independently. We will, of course, from the city side, provide some necessary information as they move along. But their timeline is entirely up to them. Their frequency of meetings is entirely up to them. And I believe that they'll meet as much as is necessary, as they deem necessary. I understand that the first meeting is in the middle of January. And, you know, we'll begin with a very broad overview of the project, or you know what the hope of the expectation might be, up to and including a see the bones kind of tour of the facility.
So the future of the Dayton Convention Center, this seems like kind of an open-ended thing. Could the function of the convention center be similar to how it operates today, or could it be completely different?
Well, really all options are on the table at this point, and if the committee or the task force determines that it's in the community's best interest to invest a significant amount of money in the venue, you know, we would be looking to the task force to bring along some suggestions for alternative revenue, because currently, we simply don't have $20, $30 million to invest in the building.
Can you explain what might happen or how the Visitors Bureau might function if there are drastic changes to the convention center's operations?
Well, I know that we have a very strong relationship with the Convention and Visitors Bureau in terms of recruiting events and or sporting events, conventions, what have you, to the facility and to the Miami Valley. But I can't speak to not knowing what the outcome is. Is it a different use of the facility than a traditional convention center? Maybe it would impact them differently. Maybe they would do their role differently. But certainly if it would close, I would imagine that there would be a significant impact for the CVB.
Joe Parlett, Deputy City Manager for the City of Dayton, thanks for your time and the information today.
Thank you very much.
The opioid epidemic has reached every community in Ohio. Because of this, hospitals, courts, and jails have become the front lines of the battle against the crisis. Those nurses, doctors, judges, and officers can act as first points of contact that connect addicts to treatment. As part of a series on recovery and roadblocks in the opioid crisis, State House correspondent Andy Chow reports on unique programs advocates believe are connecting addicts to the help they need.
Sitting behind bars, dressed in a gray inmate uniform, is Travis Oren of Columbus. He was arrested for not paying child support, but Oren faces a much bigger problem. He's been addicted to drugs for 7 years.
And once you start using, a lot of times you just give up and you just feel like there's no hope.
Hope is what Oren is starting to feel, because even though he's sitting behind bars, the Pickaway County Sheriff's Office has a program that connects Oren and other addicted inmates to treatment. The program uses medication known as Vivitrol, which has been proven to help opioid addicts.
A lot of times the same guys in and out, but now they're starting to get, you know, like the Vivitrol shot. They're trying to send them to programs so that, you know, they don't come back because it's just a vicious cycle.
Lieutenant Gabe Carpenter leads the program. Not only are inmates connected to treatment, but a deputy drives them to the doctor immediately after they step foot out of jail.
Because they're faced with that question once they leave, oh my gosh, that craving comes back immediately as soon as that, the clang of the door, and they know they want it. And so we got to try to cut that part of it off.
This way of thinking is not just happening in jails. It's in hospitals, where medical personnel try to identify addicts through a screening process, then connect them to treatment. The Ohio Hospital Association says its most conservative projections show that Ohio could be managing over 90,000 opioid overdoses annually by 2025 if current trends continue. These programs are also in courthouses, where there are special court dockets for people who are brought in on drug charges. Those people can elect to receive treatment instead. These types of measures go by many names, such as integration, coordinated care, or perhaps most commonly known, intervention.
It's really important to find people who need treatment where they are.
Joshua Sharfstein is a director of the Johns Hopkins University's Public Health School and studies what different states do to curb the opioid epidemic. He says doctors can double the probability of successful treatment if they administer medication assistance such as Vivitrol or methadone in the emergency room.
Unfortunately, many hospitals don't offer that kind of treatment, which is kind of crazy. If you think about, well, if you had a treatment that you could provide for diabetes in the emergency department, well, you'd expect every hospital to do it. And in fact, every hospital does do it.
Last year, Ohio's prisons enrolled 15,000 inmates into Medicaid so they could receive treatment once released. Special court dockets around the state helped more than 940 people get treatment and other services. Lori Chris is with the Ohio Council of Behavioral Health and Family Services Providers. They represent the groups that deliver treatment. She says these programs can grab an addict at a time in their life when they're open to help.
When a person is motivated and they have the capacity to take advantage of the opportunity of treatment available to them, then that's the time that we need to make sure we're engaged with them. So having law enforcement and hospitals know that the person's at a critical moment and connecting them immediately to behavioral health services is critically important.
Back in Pickaway County, Lieutenant Carpenter says more members of law enforcement are seeing the important role they can play by not just locking people up, but helping them for when they get out.
It's a win-win for me because not only are they getting help becoming a productive member of society, but I don't have to see the revolving cycle. You know, we're trying to break it, and it's right now that's the best way that we can do it.
That same reevaluation is happening at hospitals and courtrooms, too. For Travis Oren, he's seen the light of sobriety and felt the pain of relapse. But with this new treatment on the horizon, he feels this might be his way out for good.
There's hope out there. Just stay focused. If you go to some meetings, as soon as you get out, if you're in jail or you're incarcerated, first thing I'd do would be go to a meeting, get a support group, get connected, and just stay motivated, and it gets better. It really does.
Andy Chow, at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
And when opioid addicts try to put their lives back together, it's often difficult to get the housing, jobs, continuing treatment, and personal connections they need to stay clean and be successful. Ohio Public Radio's series on the opioid crisis continues with a report from Joe Ingles on what is being done to help drug abusers get on the right track.
A handful of students sit in this classroom in an old school building on the south side of Columbus, developing in-demand technology skills. Columbus resident David Givens is one of them. The former University of Cincinnati student studied information technology for 3 years before dropping out to take a full-time job to support his first child. His mother passed away around the same time. He became depressed and was in and out of jobs.
You know, I was hanging out with a group of friends, and all we did was party. So that led to drinking as well as, like, prescription drugs.
Givens was convicted of drug and other crimes and went to prison. Now that he's out, he's learning new job skills and looking for a company to give him a chance so he can provide for his 6 kids.
I put my children first, and, you know, they look at me as a hero. So I can't let them down.
Givens is trying to get his life back together with help from Digital Works, a company that has trained and placed more than 900 people in IT jobs since 2013. Stu Johnson says his organization helps a lot of people like Givens.
Generally, about 50% of our participants are what I would call vulnerable populations, either chronic unemployment, generational poverty, background issues, generally related to addiction issues.
Johnson says while his organization focuses on job training and employment, it works with other existing services to help those fighting addiction.
One of the symptoms of his addiction is it takes everything from you. It takes your family. It takes your friends. It takes your money. It takes your benefits. It takes your entire support system, and then it takes you.
Johnson says that's why Digital Works connects its clients with wraparound services to help them with transportation, mental health, financial literacy, or other needs. One of those organizations is Amethyst. Rachel Huddleston, a Columbus area mother of 4, is working to overcome the heroin addiction she developed after discovering her husband was hooked on it.
And I started doing heroin at the age of 26. And within 8 months, my life had spiraled out of control. I had overdosed twice in front of my children, had to be taken to the hospital and brought back to life.
Huddleston remembers the day she was arrested for burglary while her children were in the car with her. She says her 3 older daughters have been getting counseling to deal with what they've experienced.
My oldest, I believe, has PTSD because she's seen me repeatedly beat up. She has very bad stories of watching mommy puke on herself, mommy and daddy fighting over a needle.
Huddleston says she feels a lot of shame because she knows firsthand how hard it is for a kid to grow up with a troubled childhood.
My dad brutally beat my mom for 10 years, and then about the age of 6, he became very fond of me in ways that were not right.
Huddleston says the treatment she and her children have received at Amethyst have helped her to enjoy positive experiences with her children. The managing director of Amethyst, Linda Janes, says 85% of the women and families served by her organization have either mental health or trauma issues that need to be treated before the addiction.
If a client has traumatic circumstances in their background, what we've discovered is until we break through that trauma, until we get to the root of that, that client is not ready in any way, shape, or form to even begin the treatment process.
Because of that, Amethyst is a longer-term program. The average length of stay is 21 months.
What we've found is 6 months doesn't do it. 9 months doesn't do it. Sometimes 12 months doesn't do it. Many of our women have been through other short-term treatment programs, and they haven't been successful.
Amethyst program has a 90% success rate. It can help 100 clients at a time, and the demand for services is high. Janes would like more money so it can expand to meet the need, but it's expensive. It costs an average of $10,300 annually per client. But if that woman was sent to prison for her drug abuse, it would cost the state $26,300 annually to incarcerate her. Joe Ingles, State House News Bureau.
I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend on WYSO. Thanks for joining us. Today on Dayton Youth Radio, we have a story from Centerville High School from a teenager who finds closure about a family mystery.
My name is DeMarco Brooks. I'm a senior at the Centerville High School. I am smart, goofy, I'm funny. There's a lot about me that I like. My family is very protective of each other. If you lived under my roof, you would feel a lot more safe than anywhere else just because we all have each other's backs. I am currently 17 and still curious about something that has a deeper meaning to me, my mother Joanne, my father DeMarco Brooks Sr., and my younger brother and sister. I was using the restroom in my house, and there were these two dolls on top of the towel rack. Both dolls looked exactly the same, as if someone bought the same toy for their daughters so they wouldn't fight over whose looked better. Both dolls identical, same eyes, same hair, but they had on baby clothes with a different color, one red and one pink. I never understood why the dolls were there. It annoyed me because what are dolls doing in the restroom? When I got older, I asked my mom Joanne about the dolls. She didn't answer me. But I was young, curious, and could not realize how much importance it really was to her. She never said anything. She was just quiet. Whenever I would go to my dad about the situation, or about any situation, he would always send me straight to my mom, and I still would never get an answer. My family are Christians. We always go to church on Sundays. In our church, people sometimes give a testimony about how God has been important in their lives. One Sunday, the church started to talk about everyone's problems, and I remember it was loud, lights were on, and then it got quiet all of a sudden. My mother, out of nowhere, was singled out, and I knew something was wrong. At that time, I can remember our pastor saying to the church that God took my mother's two babies for a reason, and she started bawling out in tears right in front of us and the whole church, and I was so lost, I just felt so sad and hopeless. Later on that week, my mom sat me and my younger sister and brother, Yolanda and Damian, down and talked to us about my two sisters. I remember her telling us that they were really beautiful, just not healthy enough to live. Both were underweight and had trouble breathing. The doctor told her they wouldn't make it through the night. My mom was so devastated. She stayed the whole night with them, talking to them as if they were the best of friends since kindergarten. My mother had told me she got the dolls for remembrance. The dolls are very important to my mother and mean the world to her. We all hugged it out and told my mom it would be okay. You still have us. And she smiled and hugged us even harder. Finally, after hearing the whole story and finding the truth about my two sisters, it honestly makes you imagine a lot. What would they have been like? What sports would they have played? How tall would they be? What are their favorite colors? Wish I could have one chance to meet my sisters. It would really be a dream come true. The real message of this is for teens, or actually anyone with a sibling, to appreciate that gift and tell them you love them every day. This is DeMarco Brooks for Dayton Youth Radio.
That was a story entitled Testimony, written and produced by DeMarco Brooks at Centerville High School. Special thanks to DeMarco's teacher, Trisha Rapak. For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Basine Blunt.
Support for Dayton Youth Radio comes from the Virginia W. Kettering Foundation and the Ohio Arts Council. The Supreme Court recently allowed the Trump administration's travel ban to take effect while lawsuits challenging it move through the courts. The ban restricts entry by travelers into the U.S. from eight mostly Muslim-majority countries: Somalia, Syria, Iran, Libya, Yemen, Chad, North Korea, and Venezuela. The restrictions have sparked controversy since a previous version of the policy was announced earlier this year. The ban is also fueling uncertainty among hundreds of affected international students on college campuses across the Miami Valley. WISO News intern Angela Hatcher reports.
At Miami University, Darshini Parthasarathy fears for her own status on campus. Darshini, who goes by Darsh, is a junior studying political science and psychology. She was born and raised in the United Arab Emirates. The country borders Saudi Arabia and is not far from Yemen, Iran, and other countries included in the travel ban. Darsh's parents are originally from India. She's Hindu, not Muslim, and her country is not included in the ban. But sitting on a couch at the university's Office of Diversity Affairs, she says she's still worried about the ban because the UAE is overwhelmingly Muslim.
Not every other country is populated with Muslims, right? And that's what's being targeted right now. Like, even though you won't outright say it, and that's scary. Like, what if UAE ends up being one of the countries? Do my parents need to move so I can still continue to go here?
Critics of the travel ban say it unjustly targets Muslims. The Trump administration has maintained the ban does not specifically target Muslims. Officials say the new tailored restrictions are needed to tighten immigration vetting procedures. Darsh is one of three students from the United Arab Emirates attending Miami University. Overall, there are just under 100 students from the affected countries at Miami, Wright State, and the University of Dayton. And despite the ban, officials from the three universities say they are continuing to process student visas and admission applications for students. Under the ban, students from the affected countries with valid travel documents who are already in the U.S. will be allowed to stay. But prospective international students may be subject to enhanced vetting. Michelle Streeter-Ferrari is director of Wright State University's Center for International Education. Streeter-Ferrari and her team have been working individually with students to ensure they understand how the current travel ban affects them.
Students from the impacted countries can still apply for a student visa to come and study in the U.S. So as a recruiting method and also to be very clear to students, let them know that this won't impact their ability to apply to Wright State and get a visa.
University of Dayton Director of International Student Services Tim Cao has also been fielding questions and concerns from the school's close-knit international student body.
Yeah, we've heard a lot from students. They're, you know, justifiably very concerned, worried about what this means for them and their families, both here and those who may want to come visit. It's a barrier, it's a nuisance, it's something that's concerning them, and it saddens us to see their frustration.
Miami University student Darshini Parthasarathy says the travel ban has made many Middle Eastern students on campus wonder, do they belong in America, and are they welcome here?
Why would a child want to grow up in a community where they're not accepted, or knowing that they're not accepted just because of who they believe in, or what they believe in, or what their parents have taught them, and what they see in the media?
A number of legal challenges to the travel ban continue to make their way through the court system. The cases are expected to be heard in the coming weeks. For WYSO, I'm news intern Angela Hatcher.
This is WYSO Weekend on WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. The Opera Guild of Dayton was incorporated 54 years ago. Their mission is to support opera in the Dayton region. They've given more than $2 million to the Dayton Opera, but they do more than raise money. They get school children involved in opera performance. This fall, volunteers from the Opera Guild of Dayton have been visiting local schools. They bring a professional soprano and cast a show, filling out the rest of the cast with kids from 3rd through 6th grade in all major roles for a production of Gilbert and Sullivan's Pirates of Penzance. Community Voices producer Jonathan Platt sat in on a production at Prass Elementary School in Kettering.
We are in the school gym. 4th grader Andrew is ready to go all out for the casting call for Pirates of Penzance.
I need three policemen. Three policemen.
In the middle of the floor, Andrew raises his hand high above his head.
One.
Andrew is called onto the stage. A volunteer gives him a fake billy club and a costume fitting.
So just stick your arms in there. There you go. Turn around. Oh my goodness, it seems a bit big for you, too.
The 4th grade police officers huddle with another volunteer, the acting coach.
And you're going to, during the song, you're going to put your hands up in the air and go, hurrah, hurrah. Okay? Do that. Do practice it once. Hurrah, hurrah. Good.
It looks chaotic, but it is organized. There is a dozen volunteers helping the students quickly transition into flamboyant characters of this 19th century operetta. Josh is cast as Frederick, the lonely pirate that does not want to be a pirate anymore.
I've never really acted that much before, so I'm not really sure how good I'll do.
The first act begins. Five pirates come downstage singing the pirate birthday song. The audience, reading from cue cards, joins in. Then Major General Stanley and his daughters prance on stage and all eyes are on Mabel. And then Frederick is left alone with Mabel. Giggles and chatter cease because Mabel, for the first time, sings.
Steve, Steve,
It all begins to come together. The volunteers, dressed all in black, surround the ensemble and keep eye contact with their students on stage. As each volunteer makes a gesture, such as a twirl of a parasol or a waving of a billy club, so does the actor on stage. A dual performance led by the old hands of the opera. No surprise that the Opera Volunteer International awarded this company Partners in Excellence for outstanding service in 2017. After the show, I found Josh, the lonely pirate, changing out of his costume.
What did you think when that beautiful opera singer was looking you in your eyes lovingly?
It was creepy. It was kind of weird, but I didn't enjoy acting. It was a fun experience. This is actually my first time ever acting. So.
Wow. Do you think you'll do it again?
Yeah, maybe.
Later, I spoke with Tammy Schaff and told her that the student she sang to found the experience kind of creepy. She laughed. The more bashful they are, the more she'll put it on. And in the end, she said, she won him over to opera. And that's the whole idea. Many of the volunteers were won over when they saw the Opera Guild perform at their school many years ago. Now they get the opportunity to carry on that appreciation to current educators and, yes, enchantment for the kids. For WYSO's Culture Couch, I'm Jonathan Platt.
Culture Couch is made possible by a generous grant from the Ohio Arts Council. This is WYSO Weekend.
This is Bill Felker with Poor World's Almanac for the third week of early winter and the first quarter of the bedding plant moon. It's winter solstice week and the first week of the sun in Capricorn. The sun reaches its winter solstice declination on December 21, and that same day it passes from early winter's prophetic Sagittarius into Capricorn. The sun of Capricorn is the sign of the year's end and of its beginning, the fulcrum on which the longest nights of the year balance and fall into January and then turn toward June. Those born beneath the sign of Capricorn are sometimes said to be ruled by Saturn, the planet that is associated with time and aging. As the new year of 2018 unfolds, Saturn remains Capricorn's constant companion, leading that constellation across the night sky. It is visible far in the west after sundown this week, then disappears until late winter, when it takes Capricorn into the morning. And so the late evening star, Saturn, planet of time, accompanied this solstice by the slim crescent bedding plant moon, carries us, as well as the Capricorn sun, from dark December into shorter nights and brighter days. We make our lives by the sun and the stars and the planets, even if we do not believe astrologers. We live by the seasons, are led by the great sky signs from one age to the next, and we can welcome Capricorn as a gateway to what we will become as its cold turns into pussy willows of Aquarius, and then into the daffodils of Pisces, and then into Taurus and all the flowers of May. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the final week of early winter. In the meantime, along with the other saviors of your life, welcome the gifts of Capricorn's solstice and Saturn's wheel of time. Poor Will's Almanac for 2018 is available from Amazon. And you can purchase my book, Home is the Prime Meridian, Essays on Time and Place and Spirit, from the same site. The collection contains a number of the selections heard on this radio segment.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs.
Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WYSO.org.
That's it for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. I'm Jerry Kenny. WYSO Weekend will be on hiatus for the next 2 weeks. We'll see you in the new year. Coming up next on WYSO, it's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.